Welcome to Middle Brow, a service of Scriptorium Daily here at the Torrey Honors Institute, happily housed at Biola University, America's premier Christian college. With my usual friends, this is John Mark Reynolds. Paul Spears is with me today, usual partner in crime. Say hello to your mother, Paul.
Hi.
And that was, but that's gripping radio, Paul. That's why we always have you here every time. Yes, Socrates. Not here, Fred Sanders, who's on sabbatical, writing two of the most important books ever written in the history of theology in America today. Yes, we miss you, Fred.
Ever written in the history of
ever
theology
in
today.
Theology. Ever, today.
Is he writing them
simultaneous?
Today
no, there. It's the biblical today. This is the
this
day
is the
of
already,
the Lord.
This is the already not yet.
This is the day of the Lord. The person giving me a hard time there, because I'm grammatically intensely challenged, is Matt Jensen.
I don't speak so goodly.
Who is theologian to the stars. Matt Jensen.
That's awesome.
Best I can think of few worse jobs than
theologian to the stars.
To the stars. Yeah.
Scientology,
I
created by
ball,
Matt
though.
Jensen.
Wow.
How do you feel about Scientology, Matt Jensen?
Okay, moving on.
Is it your favorite fake religion? Anyway, oh, do not sue us, Scientology people. We love you. Kitsch
we
is
like
the
Kuku.
Big idea to go through the digital martyrdom. So I actually think Kitsch, let's call this stuff so bad it's good again in some ways. We're going to think about that, talk about that. Does it have any place in our lives? I actually like collecting that sort of thing. When I go on vacation, we'll look for something that's sort of perfectly awful but fun from the place we go to, sometimes for presents for others, sometimes for my bookshelves. I'll rotate Kitsch around because having a lot of books is sometimes very, I don't know, intimidating to students when they come in. So I'll get some Disneyland Kitsch, some Knott's Berry Farm Kitsch, and scattered around, it reminds me of good times I've had at places. But it also softens the sort of super seriousness of the office. I mean, I tend to like Rossetti artwork or stuff that's pretty serious itself, the Imperial Russian family, not a jolly walk in the park. And so having a little Kitsch around helps. Maybe the best example, the Walter and Cordelia Knott commemorative plate that's up on my bookshelf.
I mean, if you eBayed that, that's probably worth like
a dollar.
A quarter.
Okay, it's
Cordelia
worth a dollar.
Very bad air.
She was having a bad area.
You would think
day.
That they would hold back on the plate painting.
All right, I've given the justification for Kitsch. Why do I do it? Why do I like
do
it?
Know what is the justification again?
Yeah, I can't. I'm not clear.
It's sort of fun and softens what might be overwhelming.
So are you trying to say
office.
That junk makes your office
yeah, junk.
Look not so intimidating?
Okay, Paul, you hate Kitsch, so go for it. Tell me what you hate about it.
Well, I hate the fact that people are encouraged to spend money on things that have no intrinsic value.
So you're a snob. What you're saying is
clearly
you can't have fun because you're so busy being a snob.
That's exactly what I was saying, and that I feel better than most people because I don't have Kitsch.
Yeah,
which even the word Kitsch doesn't really cover it. It's the nice way of saying garbage in my house.
Okay, garbage in my house. Matt Jensen, garbage in my house.
Well, I just know the kind of music that Paul listens to, and I think he's offering us a double standard. I think that their material Kitsch is something he won't allow, but musical Kitsch is something that he can't get rid of and doesn't want to.
Okay, give me an example. I confess to a soft spot for Before My Time,
wait,
the 60s boy
Paul's
band
Kitsch?
Of Monkees. No, give me an example of Paul's musical
Kitsch. Whoa, this is not my...
Paul, do you like Journey?
Yes,
I
Paul,
do
you like
Journey?
Journey?
Paul, did you introduce me to Hall & Oates?
No, I did not.
Yes, you did.
No, I did not.
Yes, you did.
Oh, you're right, I did, because it was so... You were listening to really bad
right.
music,
and
I thought I had to the bad music
you
were listening to.
I listened to really bad music,
no.
So I went to, not
that
the background, but the foreground of my mind, and thought, what
no,
else do I
clearly,
know?
Clearly, I was just deeply participating. Wow, no, I
So,
am...
Paul, can you tell us why ear candy is worse than material candy sitting on my bookshelves?
I'm not advocating for my bad taste either. It's still junk.
So you should not listen to Hall & Oates.
So
no, you should really not probably. And actually, I don't listen to Hall & Oates. I just noticed the music he was listening to was so bad that it reminded me.
Okay,
of another very
you
bad
know,
band.
You know you listen to kitschy music.
Mostly,
Probably, I mean,
probably
U2,
mostly not, actually.
U2 doesn't count as kitschy music, I would say. It's pop music. It's not awesome music. But Simon and Garfunkel seem like a good... Let's pick a 60s group, since I mentioned the Monkees.
Actually,
who do
No, I would argue that's not kitsch.
My point is, Simon and Garfunkel isn't
kitsch.
The
corollary
are.
Between that junky plate up here that I'm looking at and that music?
Oh, how about this song, That's Not My Name? You know that song?
No, no. Go ahead.
Contemporary enough?
Yeah.
I will sing that if you will sing one of your older songs from the early
80s. No, there's no way I'm singing on Middle Brook.
So I would say disco. If you like disco.
I do love disco.
See? But that's kitsch. That is kitsch.
Almost all of it. Yeah. Anything Olivia Newton-John ever sang is kitsch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a double album that I am... I don't know if I'm even ashamed. I'll just admit, I have a double album. It was a gift that is a live recording by Peebo Bryson and Roberta Flack.
Wow. It's Roberta Flack can't be kitsch, right?
They're phenomenal singers, but I mean, it's pretty kitschy. God Don't Like Ugly is the name of the woman.
Okay, Bing Crosby is not kitsch in the 30s and 40s when he's singing serious crooner music, but when he did Little Drummer Boy with Sting, was it?
No, Sting, David Bowie.
Oh,
Sting
he did it with David Bowie.
Big. Thing yeah, was like four.
Later
well,
in
and
time.
This
that
actually,
was kitsch.
This actually brings up a distinction, too. I mean, kitsch and camp aren't the same things, but they're pretty
close.
Okay, that may have been campy then. When Bing Crosby sings with David Bowie, and that's got
to
be
the
most bizarre YouTube ever.
I think that was an attempt of Bing to resurrect
well,
his career.
And I think he died the next year and killed him.
Bowie's a great example because Bowie is camp and really good music. So he actually fits in both.
Okay,
camps,
what's the difference between camp and kitsch?
Oof.
I think there
is there a
no,
difference
there's an
in
no,
your
there's
head.
An intentionality. You know that you're being over the top. Where oftentimes kitsch, these people are serious. Like this plate.
Okay,
this is memorial to the family moment, and if you broke it, there
now,
would
I'll
be
I'll give you an
tears
example
shed.
In one guy's life. William Shatner in the 70s probably meant to make a good record in Transform
That's
Man.
It's awful. Awful.
But when he made Has Been, which got nominated for a Grammy. Was sort of intentionally bad, campy, but he has that gripping voice, and some good musicians came in and gave him some good poetry.
Nothing
to
like
read.
Rocket Man. Go
yeah,
YouTube
yeah,
Batman.
No, no. Yeah,
so what
Rocket
about
Man,
later in the 90s, kitsch. When at the MTV Music Awards, William Shatner presented all of the songs up for a Song of the Year in his sort of spoken
That's
word.
Camp.
Yeah, Guns N' Roses, You Could Be Mine.
Yeah, because let's face it, William Shatner is probably the best person who's ever lived at getting your attention. He knows how to speak in that Shatner-esque way that he learned as a Shakespearean actor, amazingly, in Stratford, Canada, and getting your attention. That's why the person who did Has Been hired him, because he realized he was at a party with young adults. Shatner did a Priceline commercial, and everyone stopped to listen to it, because he could just cut through the bull, and you had to listen to him. That's camp, when Shatner meant to be campy, and you're saying it's kitsch when he thought he was doing something good.
Like Rocket Man,
and he really was a joke.
Yeah, I think camp also has an overtone of sexuality to it, too. So usually when people talk about something that's campy, there's some sort of sexual
Don't
reference.
Say that around William Shatner, please.
Well,
like,
no,
later
no, I
William
mean, yeah,
Shatner,
I mean,
that's
and
disturbing.
And I think part of it is it's a sexual joke. Right?
Okay,
I mean,
get
I think,
it. So there's
I
a kind
of that, too.
So sometimes camp.
He may have been smoldering at one sort of for one small window of time to a certain set of women. Now he really is just kind of funny.
Yeah, he's a heavy guy still playing the hey, in the 1960s as Captain Kirk, right. I was the hottest guy ever, and now, you know, I'm 70 odd years old, almost 80, still playing that role knowing I'm being funny.
And he can't be lecherous. If he weren't being funny, he'd be lecherous.
Yeah, and so okay, the difference between camp and kitsch. So maybe what I was defending earlier was camp. Kitsch, though, still seems fun because when you buy it, aren't you doing irony with the product? So you put it up, you put the little Mickey Mouse up in your office, and you know you juxtapose it with a Play-Doh book, and there's a little bit of comedy in that, a little bit of self-deprecating fun. I like Knott's Berry Farm, I really do. It's a great place to eat, the chicken dinner restaurant there. It's a little campy, a little kitschy. But when you're doing it, if you're aware of it, Paul, isn't it a little bit different thing than if you went to Knott's Berry Farm, you bought the plate, and you thought it was the most awesome piece of art ever?
Right. So isn't that the problem, though, is that there's no sort of distinction? It's sold as something great, And most of the time.
But in my office, it appears on top of the Nicene and Anti-Nicene Fathers complete set. So there is a context there that's a little different than the Knott's Berry Farm gift shop.
Your context might be the thing that changes it, right?
Oh, all right. Okay,
but
I get
that. But the intentions of those selling them the wares isn't.
And by buying it, in some ways, I participated in the destruction of our
but
culture.
But it isn't. Then you get the irony when you purchase it, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe that's too cynical on my part.
And maybe there's three contexts.
That's
the context of those who sell it in sincerity, and there's a real potential problem to say, really, this is the most meaningful you can do? There's the context of people who buy it in irony as kitsch. I guess there's...
Right. Well, and that might be bad because then maybe I'm being too cynical and uppity. Right? Oh, so, I'm really beyond all this.
Yeah, and actually the thing that I wonder about is whether, I love kitsch, but whether we start to, irony kind of creeps to the point that we see everything as kitsch. So we see a truly sweet moment, whether it's in an artwork or even in a relationship, and all we can do is make it ironic. All we can do is see it, which is very uncomfortable. So yeah. To me, that's a worry. I love kitsch. My worry sometimes with myself is that I won't be able to have a kitsch-free moment.
I've noticed that less and less, Paul, and then I'll throw this over to you, that people write love scenes. It's very hard to write a love scene because, in fact, what people say when they're in love and ask each other to marry each other is, I love you, will you marry me? And you tend to say things like, I love you more than my life. And these things have been said so many times
that
when they're said, even in real life, you really do love the person. I tend to sound a little ironic just so that Hope won't laugh at me or something because we've kitschized everything. Is that what you're worried about, Paul? I'm kind of seeing that maybe I'm wrong here.
Yeah, I think that what happens is, well, one, I think kitsch is actually something that's not as good as, so if I think about the plate that would be real fine china. And then I think about the plate from the Knott's Berry Farm. And I think there is radical distinctions. And to conflate the two is they are only similar accidentally in that one is they're both circular, right? And they have some paint on them. But other than that...
But I'm thinking about what if it's a fine china plate with the picture of Walter and Cordelia Knott?
But it's not.
But what if it were? What about Super Bowl rings? Super Bowl rings cost a lot of money because it's a lot of fancy precious metal. But it's... I mean, that's just
you think it's kitsch?
It's kitsch.
Most all of them are pretty unbearable as jewelry.
Well, nobody wears them.
They're 400-pound people, and it still looks big. I mean, it's gaudy. It's kitsch. Yeah, I think it's absolute kitsch.
Because I don't think they're meant to be, right? I think even the people that wear them often don't think this is a hideously gaudy, you know, I love the Green Bay Packers, but their colors are green and gold. And on a man, green and gold, giant piece of jewelry, if it weren't
like
a Super Bowl ring,
or something.
The same people that gladly would wear their Super Bowl ring would not wear generally a giant piece of green and gold jewelry. Some of them would, some of them wouldn't. It depends on your background and what you think looks good. When is bad taste just bad taste?
Is there
bad taste? I mean, it's a little bit socioeconomic, a little bit cultural. Are y'all being snobs?
Well, that's one thing is if I'm afraid, I like what you said about talking to your wife about how you love her. One of the things that I can do by hiding behind things and sort of being ironic and calling everything kitsch is that I don't have to actually show myself out there to the public. I can have this sort of snarky attitude towards things that I actually may really think are fun. And so my enjoyment of Journey or Earth, Wind, and Fire or, you know, name other things like this, I try to be too self-protective. Rather than just saying, no, that's just, I just like that thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with having it per se. I just don't think, I think you also need to know it for what it is. So I will not say that Journey is the height of, you know, Wagner, Journey, Beethoven, somewhere in that order, I think. No, of course not. So I think being aware of it is also an important aspect.
I get a little disturbed too, Matt Jensen. When I watch a black and white movie, it's a movie from the 30s and 40s, acting styles have changed, but you ought to be able to account for that. Theater standards have changed. We like different kinds of shots. But you watch a Frank Capra film, and you no longer can just watch. It's a very well-made film. Jimmy Stewart is an awesome actor. And people somehow can't translate culturally. They can't be culturally sensitive the way they would be if they went to another country. And they can't get how gripping, emotional, and moving a very well-made film like Meet John Doe. It's not with Jimmy Stewart. I think it's Gary Cooper who's the lead in that. Great actor. It's a Wonderful Life. Now, it's been shown too many times, so it can become bad that way. But that's an excellent movie made by one of America's best filmmakers. But we have young adults who can't be emotionally moved by it because they're sort of culturally insensitive chronologically. They're snobs.
Well, and I think we're at once more sentimental and more suspicious of sentiment. And I think both of those are really problematic. We're so sentimental, everything's schlocky, but we also feel like there needs to be caveat for everything.
But Frank Capra is not John Tesh, right? Frank Capra is not the painter of light.
Well, no, we see everything as sentiment too, I think. So we see a happy ending and we think it is schlocky.
Why is it the case that if I tell you I'm going to go take you to see a serious film, it won't be a Frank Capra film like You Can't Take It With You, even though that's probably one of the best films ever made? I mean, are happy endings worse than sad endings in terms of telling the truth about life? So, you know, depending on how you tell the story of my marriage, the seventh year of my marriage was a total disaster through my own fault. I've talked about that. My early 20s, a total disaster. So apologetic for them. But if you told the story of my married life now and ended it, I'm probably the happiest married guy I know. No offense to Paul. I mean, I don't know, but I'm as happy as I believe that. Despite the problems we have, we struggle with depression, both of us. We just struggle with the past. We're happy. Is it okay that we're happy, Matt Jensen?
I hope so.
But I think people get irritated by happy endings. If you made a movie and you ended it this year or today, you know, maybe something sad will happen to us. I hope not. God have mercy on me, a sinner. Is it okay if, Matt Jensen, you seem like a pretty happy person. If we made a film of your life, we show you warts and all, but we ended it, would it be okay to end your story happily?
Yeah. And I think we would suspect that. Now, I do also think when people hear you say the seventh year of my marriage was so difficult, all of a sudden we are able to rehear the rest of the story. So part of this is an understandable concern to have a sort of rounded picture in any story. And that's appropriate.
As opposed to it just got better and better. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we're also saying is that it's okay to have just, there's a good side to the goofy side of us and the fun side, the sort of side that likes these kind of plates. It's just not, so there's nothing wrong with that. There is really a sense that I think part of our joy in life comes from sort of being on that other side, right? On that other edge.
Is new media going to kill this? So let me throw this question out. We do a Christmas party. We're not going to talk about it a lot, the Dead Kitty Party. It's just kind of fun and a little kitschy. A little campy.
A little.
A campy would be the better term. We're making fun of ourselves.
Yeah.
And deflating sort of, I'm the big faculty member. Now, here's the problem. One thing I do, which I will say that I do, is I frequently bring out the Disneyland giraffe hat I got once for marching in a Disneyland parade.
That's tremendous.
And there's something funny about seeing your teacher in a giraffe hat. Here's what I have to deal with. If a student YouTubes that, and I'm reading something serious, and an opponent puts up something clownish I'm doing, then that deflates my ability to say serious things. So am I going to have to get to the point, given technology, that I can't let go with the Python-esque, well, anything not Python-esque. If I'm making fun of things, I can always do that kind of humor because that makes me look cool-ish. I can never be cool. But I can't wear a giraffe hat anymore, even in my own home with students, because somebody's going to YouTube it on their camera phone.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying, John, is you're not saying that I would be embarrassed if people knew that I was goofy at times.
No, I certainly would not. I just told people that I'm goofy a lot of the times.
But I think the problem is the way that new media, we haven't yet come to terms with the flattening of things. And so in other words, you can spend hours and days and weeks crafting words in something that's very intentional and thoughtful that you want to represent the way you think about reality. And then you can have this moment of goofiness that is a great buffer to keep sobriety from taking over things. And it's just a great thing to do in its time.
Or to puncture my own balloon. Look, you can take yourself too seriously as a teacher. Let's talk about Plato and my thoughts. But there are different contexts, and you're right, it flattens us. Paul Spears, I know you have the same kind of goofy tendency. You'll come in and sing Paint Your Wagon in an off-key kind of way. Do you have to stop doing that?
No, I hope not. I hope that part of the fun about being human is to have those moments that are whimsical. And whimsical moments don't take a lot of forethought. And if they do, they're no longer that thing. They're not expressions of joy that naturally come out of us when good things are happening or when we feel, you know.
Okay, but Paul, you just won Teacher of the Year here at Biola, not just in Torrey, but here at Biola. Our committees, let's suppose you didn't want to work here anymore and we're looking for a new job, and they Google you, which everybody would do, and they see that prize, that's good, that's in your favor, but then they also see the equivalent of the giraffe hat video of you.
I actually have a picture of me when I was in their Sayers, I think it was, where I actually, the joke was, if you said something too sarcastic, you have to wear these... I think they were donkey ears.
Yeah.
And so I put them on for like 4 seconds, and that picture is everywhere and actually showed up last year on my door, blown up into large, thank you, Dustin Stevie.
In a large way. Yeah. So, Paul, is it the case that until, Matt Jensen's point, we get used to this? I mean, poor Barack Obama likes to smoke cigarettes. Here's a man who almost always looks good. He's so comfortable in his clothing. I mean, if you're a male, you just envy Barack Obama's ability to be photogenic. And he's 2 years older than I am and looks like a decade younger. Come on. We have a picture of him smoking a cigarette or looking goofy, and it's suddenly everywhere.
Or he hit his head on the helicopter on, Marine One? If Barack Obama
is going to be treated this way, I mean, the rest of us are just doomed, right? Any moment any moment of revelation dooms us.
So maybe the argument is, look, be comfortable in your own skin. Enjoy the things that you like. Come to an understanding of why you do them, and don't worry so much about what everyone else is thinking. Even if someone else thinks they're junk and may even have justified reasons to believe that, that just seems like, okay.
Yeah, which I think is both... freeing and a little naive. I mean, I think most of that is just a great word, because reality is we have to suck it up. We're going, these sorts of public new media embarrassments will happen for everyone. And
if they can happen to Barack Obama, Matt Jensen, you're not nearly as cool as Barack Obama, right. And you're what, 17 years younger than he is?
I don't even know.
I think he's 47. Quite a bit. Right, so quite a bit, you know, he's always going to be way cooler than you are, because like John F. Kennedy, he's just one of those people. If he can be made a clown, you're in deep trouble. So you're just not going to give up, but you were going to say that's a little naive.
But yeah, I think there still is a filtering we do. There are certain pictures that I don't put on Facebook. There are certain things that I won't say in public forums. And yeah, partly that's something that we've always done. I think there are new complications to it with new media because it's new.
Well, because your really good friend may be, so you say, I'm not going to have a Facebook page, I'm not going to disclose at all, but your friends can. Then you can't control it at all.
Right.
So you have a friend, and you know, you have professional language, and I'm not talking about swearing here, I'm just saying you have language you use professionally, and then language you use with friends.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody decides to record the language you use as friends, put it up on the web where it's now heard without context. It might be non-grammatical. It might be just not the way you want to sound. I don't think you can do that anymore. And be sure that you can keep your life in different contexts. Are we going to have to cut everybody slack? So we got to look at a video of Barack Obama and say, what's the context of that before I laugh? Or is that just impossible? You're just always going
to
laugh?
I don't even think it's bad to laugh. I think it's bad to use that as a measure of judgment on an individual. I think it's kind of funny that the president hit his head on Marine One the first time he got on.
Yeah, but I'm a little sick of Barack Obama teleprompter jokes. To tell you the truth, it's gone a little bit to the point where you're saying, you know, if I were Barack Obama and I lived in this kind of scripted age, I might walk around with a teleprompter too, because every you say appears on YouTube from malicious people. People just hate your guts. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to look at the blog and say, I didn't vote for Barack Obama, but he's my president. I want to have the right respect for him. Has respect disappeared in a new media world? Matt Jensen, is it possible to respect somebody when you know every single thing about them?
It ought to be, but I think it's a feat of imagination to respect when we have as much information as we have. In other words, we have to discipline ourselves to filter that information which rightly should shape our ideas of other people. And that's that stuff which we should just recognize as as just fluff. It's just stuff that everyone goes through. So he bumps his head. That shouldn't affect whether I respect him. So there's some things that he might say that I should really alter.
We all know, you know, Harvard Law Review professor at University of Chicago, that Barack Obama is smarter than we are, mm-hmm. or at least smarter than the average American. But you can use YouTube without lying and paste together a series of statements by the president that make him look clownish. Certainly was done to George W. Bush, by the way, to give equal time. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush, again, had SAT scores to get into Yale that most people, even in Tory, would have been okay with having. They were honors SAT scores. And yet, tape him all day, easy to make a man with dyslexia look clownish. Totally insensitive. What are we going to do about this? Last thoughts, Paul Spears. Kitch, is it okay in the context of the real world we live in?
Yeah, I think it is, and I just think that we have to understand. I think Matt's right about prudence, but I also think that I wouldn't want to lose the person that I am because I'm trying to cover up for the potential mishaps that could happen. I should be aware of the opportunities and my context, but I think I should also be clearly aware that I also need to be fully human, and stifling those kinds of things, I think, undercuts that
opportunity. I'm going to push back 1 second, Paul. So your wife bought you a really flowery, cool Valentine, very 80s, when you were 22. Do you still frame it and put it on your wall because she loved you and it says something to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and too bad if your students have a little snicker about it.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Man, Jensen, any thoughts on this topic?
I think we enjoy Kitch partly because it reminds us that we don't have good taste and never will have perfect taste. And it's, yes, it's probably a parable about the character of our lives, which I think is something.
Let me add one more thing about Kitch that
Paul
I think
Spears.
Will be helpful. Is my kids, kids buy ties or soap on a rope, those kinds of things for their fathers.
Yes.
My kids decided that what they wanted to get me were Eeyores, and those are at Disneyland.
Right.
And they're like $4 or $5 for an Eeyore. There might be a little more now.
Yeah.
But they were inexpensive things that they could cobble together money and purchase for me. I must have 15 of them.
Yeah, a fair amount of
Eeyores that
I
light
have,
up, Eeyores that make Christmas music, Eeyores that have wings on them, Eeyores that are dressed in Santa Claus costumes. I mean, I have tons of them.
I got you an Eeyore once.
Yeah. And so, and they're kitschy. And I'm never giving them away. And
right.
I will always, because of the relationship of the gift to my kids.
Yeah.
That's why. And I think the second that I were to decide to give them away because they were a little embarrassing is to actually...
That's bad taste.
Yeah,
that that would be in bad taste. And I have to say, and if you're listening, we're appreciative, that many of the people I've known who have the best taste, who have been good donors to Tory but collect world-class art, have also been the people with the most tolerance for other people's taste and kitsch.
Wow.
Not in their own lives. In their own lives, they are people of impeccable taste. But they are the least showy, the least judgmental of anybody I know. Matt Jensen, we'll give you the last word on this topic. Kitch or camp, what should we make of it, these issues of taste and purchasing?
I think we should enjoy that as a part of our approach to culture and be grateful for the things that we love without justification and work hard, though, I think, to cultivate a rich enough and broad enough aesthetic that it's not the whole of our consumption of culture.
Yeah.
I think we should also always assume that the people we're dealing with are sincere. Mm-hmm. This podcast will be posted either around or near the time of the sinking of the Titanic, April 14th. That's something that works for me. That story still makes me cry. We've remembered it as a family in prayer. Now, that's a little silly, and I get that, and there's lots of Titanic catch out there, particularly after the 1990-something movie. But when we look at somebody, different stories sometimes move us deeply. We don't know why we think about it. That's a long time ago. It had nothing to do with me personally. But it's a good window into someone's heart.
Mm-hmm.
And too often we laugh or mock at something that's actually deeply personal. How do I learn to handle that? I learn to mock myself and be a little kitschy about it and campy. The truth is, the story of the Titanic makes me cry. But I don't want anyone to know it, so let me camp it up. And then nobody will know that it really makes me cry. They'll just assume, oh, John Mark's in on the joke and make fun of it. It's good for me to have people that deflate my balloons. Paul and Fred like to do that occasionally because I need it. But it's also good to have good friends. Paul and Fred would certainly fit this, and Matt's becoming like this, who can also come alongside me and say, yeah, that's not our taste, but we're really glad to see that soft side of you, that side that's sentimental, that cares about things that we don't care about, but it's kind of cool that you care about. And each one of us have that sort of thing. Well, Kitch, camp, things we're sentimental about, fluffy puppies, I suppose. Those things have undergone the digital martyrdom. Here on Scriptorium, on the Middle Brow podcast, this is John Mark Reynolds for Matt Jensen and Paul Spears wishing you a kitschy, campy, sentimental kind of day.